Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. In our culture, visual art tends to be viewed as an activity focused on personal aesthetics, not public dialogue. That perspective is not universal. In some parts of the world, a great deal of art is overtly political, and some of that is street art, paintings and drawings made in public places where it can stimulate community dialogue. Samantha Robison knows. Descended from a Montana ranch family, for the past 5 years, she's headed a team that creates public art in places racked by conflict, Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Palestine. Samantha, many thanks for joining us on Homeground.
Of course. Absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Well, I grew up in the D.C. area in Maryland. My mother worked as a contractor for the federal government doing research, and my father worked for the Indian Health Service.
Did you learn anything about either one of their professions growing up?
I think with my father, it was about working with a group of people that was a minority, and that the American people are made up of many different groups, and Indians are part of that, or Native Americans. It's still called the Indian Health Service, even though we maybe have moved past the term Indian in our political spheres.
Depends on which tribe. It's interesting who you talk to. In the Southwest, it's different than up here.
Yeah.
So you developed a concrete awareness of different groups, ethnic groups, and the diversity of our country, I gather.
Most certainly. And I think, like, in our house growing up, my father and my mother had lots of artwork and different things from particularly the Navajo and the Hopi culture. There would be these dolls. They were called Kachina dolls, if I'm not wrong. And it's like from a very long time ago that I have these memories, and these sand paintings and things like that.
Wow.
And the pots. And so it was a part of different cultures that were involved in our home.
Very interesting. Where'd you go to high school, college?
I went to high school in Maryland, and it was in a small town called Poolsville, and it was Poolsville High School. It was about 30 to 45 minutes from Washington, D.C., and I went to college in Portland, Oregon, at a school called Lewis and Clark College, and it was a small liberal arts school.
How did you end up making that choice? That's a long way from Washington, D.C.
I think I always had a rather adventurous spirit, and I wanted to try something new and different and get to know a different part of the country. It was still in the States, but the West Coast is very different culturally to the East Coast. And I wanted to have an adventure, I think, and learn something different and challenge myself.
And did you surprise yourself? Did you challenge yourself? Did it work out the way you expected?
I think so, certainly. Lewis and Clark was, I think, what a lot of people, for lack of a better term, would call a hippie school. And they really challenged a lot of the things that I think. And I had a lot of really great professors who taught us to think critically and not to just accept things, but to really challenge ideas.
For example,
I had a political science class. It was a political philosophy class. And we would go through all of the major political debates, such as vegetarianism or abortion. Or, for example, one of my professors was from Iran, and he was a former advisor to the Shah. And a lot of our preconceptions that we had about the Middle East and about Iran and about Arabs and particularly terrorism, he challenged a lot of that. And he would get into the intricacies of how the region evolved and also U.S. influence on the region that we might not necessarily be aware of.
So overall, how did you rate your experience and what you hoped for?
I think it was a hypothetical 11 out of a scale of 1 to 10. It was really amazing and challenged me to travel and experience other cultures as well.
Your major was?
I had political science as a major and a minor in art.
Why both? That's an unusual mix.
I think it played into two different interests that I have. I've always been very interested in aesthetics and in art, and the impact that that has on people psychologically, and also politics. When you grow up in the Washington, D.C. area, I think you're always surrounded by it. And there was always a conversation going on about politics, and it's always piqued my interest my whole life. And so that's the other part.
So as you graduate with that degree, what happens next?
Well, I graduated in 2008, and that was a big question for us because there was a lot of economic turmoil.
Sure.
And a lot of question marks. And when I graduated with that degree, my first idea was I wanted to go overseas. and experience some different cultures. And an easy way for me to do that was teaching English. And I had met some people previously in my travels, and they had suggested working in East Asia, in Korea specifically. And so my first job out of university was teaching English in South Korea.
How was that, in summary, as an experience?
It was very interesting to see the education system. I think you learn a lot about a culture when you see its education system and the way, the value that the society has within that, whether it be the way that people learn facts or the way, whether they think critically.
How was it in South Korea specifically?
It was very much a facts-based memorizing culture, like, for example, the Rubik's Cube. A lot of my students would know how to do the Rubik's Cube simply because they had memorized it, but not because they had critically learned how to do it. And I think in our society, particularly within liberal arts education, we're taught to think critically and we're taught to examine things not just to know facts. And it's not what you know, but it's how you can approach a problem.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Samantha Robison, founder and executive director of a program called Awareness and Prevention Through Art, or APT Art for short. Tell us about it.
It's an acronym for Awareness and Prevention Through Art, and the idea is that we build awareness and promote prevention of issues that affect communities, and we put a focus on youth throughout the world and give people access to the arts. It's built on the idea that all people, regardless of race, religion, class, conflict, deserve access to free expression and the arts. And we do that by creating collaborative public art pieces in their communities and then also exhibiting them internationally.
There's a lot there in what you just said, so let's break it down. Everyone deserves free expression was one thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
You just pointed out in South Korea there's a difference in educational system, memorize the facts rather than critical thinking.
Yes.
In some countries that you've worked in, what we regard as freedom of speech is not acceptable, contrary to certain religious values, etc. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that problem for openers?
Yeah, 100%. I think in a lot of cultures, free expression isn't valued, and the individual isn't valued. And in trying to deal with that, it can be a challenge, but we approach it from the perspective of speaking with community leaders and explaining to them what we're doing. And we do limit ourselves and take into consideration cultural norms. For example, in most countries, we wouldn't be painting provocative figures of women. Or we take into consideration that most women have headscarves. So if you want to relate to that culture, if we're painting in Iraq or Jordan, we would often put women in headscarves so that it becomes relatable and a message that is from those people and speaks to the average person there.
Okay, let's take this one at a time. It's highly interesting to me. First, there's an assumption in what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and in the title of your organization, Awareness and Prevention Through Art.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's saying that art has those impacts in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned working in the whole world. How big is your staff?
We do project to project, so there's about 15 artists.
Okay, it's a big world, meaning you have to make choices of where you go with your 15 artists.
Oh, most certainly.
All right.
Yeah.
How do you go about choosing first where you're going to start to have dialogue with the people who are going to allow you or not allow you to do your work? How do you go about making that choice?
I think there are areas that I would say people's voices are marginalized. And so you want to target communities that people don't hear from all the time. And I would say that Palestinians are a group that we don't hear from all the time. Or Syrian refugees. You hear a lot about the Syrian refugees.
Indeed.
But you don't hear from a Syrian refugee very often. So this is art from the actual refugees, or voices from actual refugees, not just about them, other people's commentary. It's actually from the people. And I think that's something really important, is that when you work with people, you say, we think that you're important and your voice is important and we want to hear it and the world should hear it. And it has like egalitarian values within it.
All right. Now let's take us through, this obviously is highly unorthodox, your work. Take us through a project. Give me an example.
One of the projects that we did recently was in Gaza, and I think that's a group of people that we don't hear directly from very often. It's a very isolated place for a number of different reasons.
Now, Gaza is part of Palestine, separated by Israel.
That's correct. It's an area of the Palestinian people that is still considered Palestinian territory. There's been a lot of movement in those boundaries over the years, but yes. So in Gaza, we worked with artists from Gaza as well as a German artist, and Gaza is a very isolated place. And there was a war there. There's often wars there, but there was a war there about 2 years ago. And we heard a lot about that war, but you didn't necessarily hear a lot from the people in Gaza. So we were very interested in amplifying the voices of people from Gaza and bringing them to people all over the world, particularly Americans. It's not a story that we hear very often.
If I wanted to do what you just described doing, I wouldn't know where to begin. How do you make contact in Gaza, of all places?
Well, getting into Gaza is probably one of your most difficult challenges. First, we partner with local organizations that are on the ground. So we contacted Mercy Corps, which is one of our partners that we work with in other places. And Mercy Corps has a lot of community-based organizations there that work with youth. So we contacted them and asked them if they could help us get permission to get into Gaza. And that's your biggest challenge with Gaza, is even getting in. The Israeli Authority controls whether or not you can enter it.
Who interacted with Israel?
Mercy Corps did, and the project was funded through USAID. So USAID worked with Mercy Corps, and they were able to get us the permissions. And it was quite a challenge. We weren't sure if we were going to get in, and two of the artists did not initially receive the permission. And we waited and waited, and finally they did. And two of us went in advance and waited for the other two to have their permissions.
You say the project was funded by USAID.
Mm-hmm.
Do you submit the application? Does Mercy Corps submit the application?
Mercy Corps had submitted the application for an arts project. And we, because of all of our experience, were a good candidate. And we engage a lot of local artists when we do projects. So they saw us as a good fit. So they contacted us.
They being?
Mercy Corps.
Okay.
To see if there are projects we might be interested in Palestine. And we had previously been working in West Bank with skateboarders, building a skate park. And so we were familiar with the area. And when we were there, we had met and spoken with a bunch of Mercy Corps staff.
So you developed some credibility, and Mercy Corps has credibility, and that credibility ends up being translated to satisfy the Israeli government and the Americans to support it. Is that fair?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay, now what? You're there. Some artists don't show up. Others do. What do you do?
We had made a plan B, a backup plan. If Falk, who was the German artist, was not able to get in, and I paint as well. And so when somebody can't get in or it's too dangerous, which is sometimes the situation, and artists won't come, then I will substitute in. But I am not a street artist by profession, so I generally don't paint, but I will in a pinch.
Okay, so tell me this story.
We finally got into Gaza, and I'd say it was one of the craziest border crossings we've ever done. And we have done some pretty crazy border crossings. In Congo, for example, when we were border crossing, it was during the refugee crisis, and all these people were pouring over. It took us 4 attempts to enter the country. So we have been through some crazy ones. And this one was difficult. And you had to have a different story at each checkpoint. So when you went through the Israeli government checkpoint, when you came in through the airport, you had one story of what you were doing and why you were there. And I think the Ben Gurion Airport is notorious in Tel Aviv for grilling people and putting them in isolation and talking to you about your whole life story. And then if you don't give them what they want, they just deny you entry. But we had our one story and we were successful.
There's hard to imagine a more tense part of the world.
It's true.
Than the border. They're very tough about letting you in the country. What are they want to know you're not a security threat or going to work with people they regard as a security threat.
Exactly,
okay.
Yeah.
So what happens next?
And then once you get through that checkpoint, then we meet up with our staff and the Mercy Corps people, and then they take us to another checkpoint where we get through, and we go through a secondary Israeli checkpoint to get into Gaza, and it was the Erez checkpoint. And then we get through that. And then you have another checkpoint. And this is the Palestinian Authority. And then you go through the Palestinian Authority and then you're in. And then you go through this, it's like a dead zone. There's not a lot happening there. And when you go in, it was hit really heavy during what was termed Operation Protective Edge. And all the buildings are bombed there and they're shelled and they're completely destroyed.
That must make you feel very confident as you walk in to do some artwork.
It does. Yeah, it doesn't always make you feel the safest, but that's why you're there. Because these places are suffering and have been attacked and people might not necessarily be hearing from them.
Okay, so you get through the border. What happens?
We meet up with, in the offices, with all of the Palestinian staff that we're working with. And they introduce us to the area. They take us around to the communities. The area that we worked in was called Al-Tufaha, and it was an area that was destroyed quite a bit, and a lot of the buildings had been collapsed. And when you see the buildings, you see these holes that come in through the center, through the roofs, and it's where the rockets went through, and it's boom, and you see this black circular-shaped hole, and then the whole building is caved in and collapsed from the center. And when these buildings are destroyed, this is the environment that people live in. And for children, it can be very difficult. And for people, for the entire community. And I guess that plays into our work a little bit in trying to regain ownership of the space and to try to make it a little bit more beautiful and a little bit nicer for them to live in and exist in. And we did that in this particular project by allowing artists and children to paint on the walls.
You're listening to Homeground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Samantha Robison, who is the founder and executive director of the Awareness and Prevention Through Art Project. Your description reminds me of photographs I've seen of Warsaw or Berlin or Stalingrad after World War II. A horrific situation. You're going in there with the assumption that this kind of work, which you're going to tell us about, but it's artwork, presumably involving the local people, can make a difference in the quality of their lives, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What do you base that assumption on? I mean, that's a wonderful ideal, and it also ambitious.
I think the visual environment does a lot to shape the psychological health of a population, and we're not able to rebuild all of their buildings, certainly. But adding a little bit of color and some humanity to their environment. And I think it goes a step further in the idea that we come from other places, but we're all human beings. And it shows a human solidarity and that the world has not forgotten Palestine. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of Palestinians have.
So take us through the process. You're being introduced to people in the neighborhood. What happens?
We ask them what kind of ideas they want to put on the walls and what messages are important for their community and also for the world. And I think those are two different things, but they can intertwine. And for this particular project, acknowledgement was a big issue, was they wanted the international community to acknowledge their struggle and to understand what they had been through and to incorporate children and to brighten the environment.
That's what they wanted.
Yeah.
Now what happens?
So we had worked with a German artist, and one of his skill sets that he has is painting photorealism. So what we did was we developed with the Palestinian artist this concept of bearing witness and of eyes. And eyes are a universal human trait. And
so I mean the human eye?
Yeah, the human eye. So we photographed, or he photographed, children that we had done workshops with and the things that they wanted to say on the walls. And we gave them colors, and they painted all of the things that described them or that they thought were important about them as individuals on the walls.
And what age group?
We worked with ages about 9 to 14. And we had them write all of these messages. And then overlaid on top of those messages were a pair of one of the children's eyes who participated in the project. And then a central message was put over the bottom of it, and that was done in an Arabic calligraphy, and we worked with one of the artists, Hamza, who was a very talented calligrapher. And so he had done the calligraphy portion of that project. So it was a collaboration between the Gaza calligrapher and a German artist and the children who had participated in this particular piece.
Where is this art painted?
On public walls. It's really important that they're places that are accessible to everyone, not just to a select group or in a private home. It's something that all people can see.
Outside then in the street?
Oh, on the streets, always, yeah. The streets for everybody to see. And we did it in areas that had been recently destroyed in the last conflict. Those were the communities that were most demoralized. And to try to give them messages of hope. So it was a combination of acknowledgement and hope. And there were 8 walls that were done as a part of that series.
In total, how many people were involved in the work?
I would say probably about 100.
You were there the whole time?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. People on the street, what's going on when they see you working?
Oh, they get really excited about it. And if somebody's walking by in the street and they want to paint something, we invite them and say, oh, do you want to write something? Mm-hmm. And one of the artists will explain, because they speak Arabic, explains the whole concept of the project and why we're doing it. And then they can write a message. One of the sets of eyes, the message that went with it was, I see beauty. And it was about all the beautiful things that exist in Gaza. A lot of times in the media, you hear a lot of negative things about it, but it is a really beautiful place in a lot of ways. Right. And so they have really nice beaches and these beautiful trees with red flowers. And the hospitality is second to none. And they have great food. And so there's these beautiful things that I think the world doesn't always hear about. So the messages were about beauty. And so a lady who was walking by, we asked her, what do you think is beautiful about Gaza? And she wrote, the port. And there's this port where all the fishermen go in and out in Gaza. And she thought that was beautiful. So that was one of the messages.
As you've made clear, the places you choose to work involve intense conflict. And what your work brings a mixture of politics and art. The decision makers are making political decisions. Can you come through the border? People who are antagonistic, to put it mildly, to each other, both have to decide your work is not a threat to them.
Yes.
That's not easy to do.
It's not. I do think that we have on our side children and art. Okay. And art can be a very powerful weapon, certainly, in shaping the minds of a population. But we try to pitch it in a way that makes it more about just beautifying rather than sending political messages or shaping minds, and make it very positive. And I think that's important, is that it's positive.
Okay.
And constructive.
Now, something, it's up, it's finished. You were not just exposing it to the local community, you made clear, but the idea is for the world to see it.
Certainly.
How do you try to publicize something like this and get visibility beyond Gaza?
Well, we have a lot of different media outlets. And the artist that we work with, for example, in Gaza, Akut is his street art name, or Falk Lehmann is his German name, is a very prominent street artist. Hmm. And so he uses his network to spread the word about it. And also we hold exhibitions. So we did an exhibition in Portland, Oregon, and we did an exhibition in Berlin, and we've done an exhibition in Amman with these images. And they very much so convey an idea along with the imagery.
Do you use social media?
I would say Facebook is probably one of our best outlets, or Instagram is also good.
What do they look for? Apt Art?
Apt Arts. APTARTS.
And what kind of response feedback do you get from the international audience that sees the work?
It's really positive, I think, because what we're doing is something constructive and positive. And it's not about saying something negative about anyone or any idea. It's proposing something good that we can all do together. And it's not putting any one group down. It's amplifying and raising up a bunch of ideas and a bunch of groups, marketplace of ideas.
Back to Gaza physically, you're talking about an actual war zone in temporary lull. Don't you feel threatened physically?
When there's shellings from the Israeli side, yes. But when you're just walking around on a day-to-day basis, no, the people are not threatening at all. the general feeling in the community is quite safe. The hospitality is incredible, and they're just looking out for you most of the time.
You work in countries where we would consider, generally speaking, governments are repressive. Your art challenges some aspect of life in those countries, or encourages discussion about sensitive issues. You told me about discussing feminism or women's rights. How do they take it? How do the governments react? Why do they let you do something they might not be in favor of?
I think oftentimes art can slip under the radar a little bit more than some other activities or activist movements. And I think they see it as giving voice, but it doesn't seem dangerous to them, like it's going to mobilize an uprising. And so I think we're able to get away with a lot more.
Another aspect of these highly polarized places that you work is there are an intense hatred and fear of one group against another and another and another. True or false? How do you deal with it?
True, certainly. I think a lot of our work is aimed at minimizing that fear of the other and allowing communities to be more cohesive and collaboratively construct something that they all get to enjoy. And I think that point of fear is really important because a lot of it comes from the unknown or an ignorance to the other culture or to the other religion. And I think we face that all over the world. And it's something that is dividing communities on a micro level, and it's dividing communities on a macro level. I think even within the United States, we have a lot of that happening. And a lot of people have fear of refugees, a fear of their neighbor even, a fear of the community down the road.
Implicit in your work is the assumption that art, and specifically street art, community-generated art, can help overcome in some cases that mutual fear. Do you believe that? Have you seen it?
Yes. In Jordan, on the Syrian border, there's a city called Mafraq, and they've taken in a huge number of refugees. But Jordan is not a particularly wealthy country, and resources are scarce, and a lot of anger is put on Syrian refugees because of that scarcity, and they're blamed. They're the scapegoat for a lot of issues. So we wanted to paint a mural with Syrian and Jordanian kids and communities, and the topic was about acceptance, peace, and love. And we painted it, and there was a lot of backlash from the Jordanian community, and one night, there was graffiti written on that wall, Syrians go home. And the next day we called a community meeting and all of the Syrian families came and the Jordanian. And some of them said to the Jordanian family, explained that they had come from war, that their communities were destroyed, that their brothers and sisters were killed, that their home no longer exists. And they're here because they have to and they would like to go home, but they cannot. And I think having been face to face with actual people telling those stories about their lives and why they are in these Jordanian communities and why they have to share this space really brought it full circle. And we fixed the mural with the Syrians go home with the Jordanian and Syrian kids. And that we went back a year later, and it's been almost 2 years, and we were there this past trip to Jordan, and the mural is still there untouched. And I think that that says something.
Samantha Robison, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.